It must have seemed like a miracle. A solid male figure bringing security and stability after such a detrimental relationship. But not everybody was happy with the union. Sinclair Jr., for one. He wasn't thrilled with Mama for going back into the lion's den or for moving to Detroit. For a year, the boys waited. It was January of 1968 when Mama sent for my brothers. At 14 and 12 years old, they traded the humid 85-degree weather of Fort Lauderdale for Michigan's bone-chilling 8 below. It was the first time they had ever experienced snow, and their hands and feet had never been so cold. Along with a new house and neighborhood and the unfamiliar racial tension, they were now surrounded by junior high students who openly smoked cigarettes and blatantly lived the thug life. Clearly out of their element, Sinclair and Larry had abruptly landed in Detroit's inner city with its unfamiliar rules and confrontational lifestyle. Bigotry was new to them, or maybe they had just been too young to recognize it before, but they did now. As the weeks and months melted together, Sinclair and Larry began to develop friendships as well as form new opinions. Detroit was unlike any place they had ever seen, with black people living successful lives, fathers who were doctors, lawyers, and executives working for Motown, high-ranking employees at the Big Three, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. They wore expensive clothes and drove luxury cars. But Detroit had another side, a darker, seedier side. Its streets were deceptively deadly, and one careless decision could cost you your life. Larry was a social butterfly who got along with everyone. Bestowed with the gift of gab, he easily made friends, male and female. He was also cunning and impressionable, and not entirely particular about whom he invited into his circle. In hindsight, maybe that was his only mistake. Sinclair, on the other hand, was serious and focused, and he steered clear of foolishness. He could also be sullen and reclusive, which resulted in him spending long, solitary hours with few friends. I suppose my mother gave him the space, believing every family had at least one moody teenager within its ranks. Our mom continued to heal from her first marriage, though she now suffered from anxiety due to years of abuse. Oliver remained stern and began to show signs of stress with growing impatience and increasing absence. I realize every blended household has its share of dysfunction, but ours had an underlying friction, a resistance within, where each piece of the domestic puzzle didn't quite fit. It may not have been clear from the outside, but pressure was building. In the winter of 1969, the news of my mother's unexpected pregnancy was a welcome mental break from the daily drama. The promise of something precious gave her renewed purpose. My father, however, was far less enthusiastic. Oliver didn't share the excitement about the coming birth. In fact, he was livid. With 3 daughters from a previous marriage, he didn't want or need another child, especially in his 40s. His contempt for the unplanned addition lasted throughout the entire 9 months, and during that time, he repeatedly reminded my mother that he would not be at the hospital during labor or the birth. Turns out he was bluffing. Unbeknownst to many, my dad wanted a son more than he ever let on. But with 1970s ultrasound machines being what they were, there wasn't any guarantee what the gender of a child would be. To brace himself for the worst, he rejected any involvement, thus tainting what should have been a truly special season in his life. His wife's growing belly was viewed as an antagonist with more power than any tiny being should be allowed. The power to either fortify his masculinity or threaten it. After he paced for hours across the hospital waiting room, nervously cutting a path through his poorly hidden excitement, the doctor eventually emerged from the delivery room with the news that he would be taking home a healthy baby boy. Suddenly, the dark clouds hanging over his bitter anger.